Public hearing. Good morning. I'm opening this meeting of the Subcommittee on Human Services, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It's June 22nd. We have a number of things on our agenda, and we will not be proceeding in the order that the agenda was printed. We are still waiting for at least one more senator to arrive and be available. Senator Bates will not be with us this morning. We will begin with public hearings. We're starting with a hearing on House Bill 2300, opening up. Public hearing on House Bill 2300. Ms. Toe.
Okay, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2300 establishes a method to regulate the treatment of patients with terminal diseases with investigational products. You should have the -8A8 amendment, and the -AA amendment replaces the bill and institutes a method by which attending physicians may refer a patient who has terminal disease to a healthcare practitioner who's authorized to treat patients with investigational products. It establishes parameters for the healthcare practitioners and patients eligible for treatment with investigational products, including defining the provisions for qualifying for this treatment and paying for the treatment. It requires the physician who makes a referral, a healthcare practitioner that administer the treatment, and the consulting physician to file a record with OHA, and records filed with OHA must at least provide details that includes adverse effects, positive outcomes, cost of treatment, and demographics. The bill also requires OHA to adopt rules for the collection of information from physicians who make a referral healthcare practitioner, and review annually a sample of records of patients who have terminal disease and receive treatment. And that is the amendment.
Thank you. Because we have many items on our agenda this morning, and we also do need to have a work session and pass several more pieces of budgets, I'm going to limit the public hearing testimony this morning to 3 minutes each. For House Bill 2300, we have four people signed up to testify. Samuel Metz, Dennis McNanny, could you please come up? And please start as soon as you can. Whoever's there first can start.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Samuel Metz. I'm a Portland physician who works throughout the Willamette Valley. I'm deeply conflicted about the HB 2300 Right to Try bill, and I hope when you've heard my testimony, you will be deeply conflicted as well. The FDA receives approximately 1,200 applications every year for compassionate use, and it approves all but seven of them. If we apply this nationally, there would be less than one Oregonian per decade affected by this bill. Additionally, for every Oregonian who used this Right to Try bill, there would be one Oregonian who was ineligible to participate in clinical trials of that drug or of any other drug, just therefore delaying the availability of proven and safe drugs for future patients. Because of this, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association and the Biological Industries Organization do not support Right to Try laws. Medical ethicists are uniformly against Right to Try laws because of that concern, delay of future effective drugs, and the potential for exploitation of desperate families by firms that have a financial interest in their products. Patient advocacy groups all have despaired that the FDA is inadequately approving new drugs. They have different attitudes about Right to Try laws. One group, the Abigail Alliance, believes that every state should have a Right to Try law in order to circumvent the FDA. another group, the Foundation for Access to Medicines, believes that if enough states pass right-to-try laws, Congress will reform the FDA. And the National Organization for Rare Diseases does not support right-to-try laws. There is one group that uniformly supports right-to-try laws, and those are conservative think tanks that look at this through the lens of personal liberty. In conclusion, I'm concerned that even though only a few patients will be affected, there will be more patients hurt in the future than will be helped today. Legislators who vote in favor of this bill today will receive the thanks of patients, perhaps, who have terminal diseases now. But legislators who vote against this bill will not receive the thanks of future patients who get their terminally ill treatment earlier and more effective because they don't know who they are yet. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Dennis.
Chairman Nathanson, member of the committee. My name is Dennis McNanny. I represent the Oregon Bioscience Association. We're neutral with concerns on the bill. The concerns are largely those of subverting a process that has frankly been around for almost 100 years. The FDA has been balancing this equation between safety, efficacy, for a long time. And what we feel is that this bill is not going to add much to the already existing program, as Dr. Metz talked about, the compassionate use program. I point towards the fact that no state that has passed this bill has yet issued a drug or a device under this. Now, that's a fluid situation, but I would say given the 6 to 9 months that this has been approved in other states, if there was a massive block of latency, a latent need for this sort of legislation, that we would be starting to see a landslide of successful usage of this bill, and it's just not the case. And the reason that is that it's the wrong approach. The federal government is charged with this, and there's really no way to supersede that. In fact, as the ethicists point out, there's probably no better qualified group to make these decisions at the moment. Is it an imperfect process? Yes. But they are, in fact, making fairly radical changes to make it easier to go through the compassionate use program. And for those that aren't aware, it was recently reduced from a 100-hour process to less than an hour for a doctor and a patient to go through the compassionate use program, which is already in place with the FDA and has been successfully implemented for years and, again, is in the process of reform. I would urge you to probably look at this as a fluid situation and judge it based off of the results that we see over the next year. So it's always an issue you can come back to, but at this point I just don't see that my members in the state of Oregon would be able to utilize this program in the ways that they can utilize compassionate use. So I'd appreciate you to share the same concerns our organizations and members have to give this more time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next to testify are Jessica and Steve. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. Providence has been engaged in House Bill 2300 from the beginning of this session and with significant ethical concerns. We are concerned about the impact that this would have, 23A as it's drafted, would have on children. Significantly concerned about the ethical impacts that this would have on those that are most vulnerable as they are facing significant and challenging illnesses. It is our belief that the -A9 amendments drafted in collaboration with Senator Steiner Hayward, who led that effort, along with others in this legislature, address many of those concerns, improve the bill dramatically, and with those amendments, we would be neutral on the bill. This set of laws has a potential to significantly impact the patient-doctor relationship at a time that it is most essential. But again, we believe with the A9 amendments, the bill would be dramatically improved. As I signed up this morning, I want to clarify that there are on OLIS a set of A8 amendments, but we have seen a set of -A9 amendments. And unlike what I wrote on my sign up, we are neutral with the A9s, not the A8s.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
The A9s are in.
Steve, are you ready to? You can begin.
Okay. Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst at Cascade Policy Institute, a Portland-based think tank. I was also on the work group on this bill with Jessica and others in the House that was authorized by Representative Mitch Greenlich. You have my written testimony detailing my arguments for this policy on OLIS called Right to Try is Right for Oregon. So I won't repeat those arguments, but I want to make some additional points. And I just saw the A-A8 amendment last night at 10:33 when it was posted on OLIS, and I haven't seen the A9, so I can't talk in detail about those. But I want to tell you, since most of you were not in any of the healthcare committees, about one brave young man who came to this capital the end of February to talk to the House before it voted on this bill. 14-year-old Diego Morris came to the building with his mother, Paulina, from Arizona. And he was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, a deadly form of bone cancer, when he was 11 years old. The drug that might have helped him was not approved by the FDA in the United States, but it was approved in most of Europe. So his family actually, on very short notice, moved to London for 9 months, where he got treatment, and he's now cancer-free. And when a reporter in Portland asked him what he would say to opponents of Oregon's Right to Try bill, this is a quote from 14-year-old. He looked up at the reporter and he said, "Wait until they find themselves in my situation and then ask them." In March, Representative Greenlich and I appeared together on an OPB radio show about the Right to Try bill. And we were asked, as you may know, Representative Greenlich was diagnosed with lymphoma in 2005. He was not eligible for clinical trials, but he was lucky enough to get access to an experimental drug that was outside of the clinical trials, and he's now in remission. And he was asked by the OPB reporter, what do you say to those who say that this just offers false hope to desperate patients? And Mitch said, I said, quote, "Sometimes false hope is better than no hope." And that was a much better answer than I gave. Diego Morris, the 14-year-old, has a somewhat different answer for that question. When he's asked that question, he says, "There is no false hope. There's only hope." As you've heard, maybe not in detail, 22 states as of last week, I didn't check this morning, but 22 states have already passed laws, similar Right to Try laws, as the one you're looking at now since early 2014. House Bill 2300A passed the House by 59-0. And it's already, if it passes in that form, it's already or will be the most restrictive Right to Try law of any of the ones that have been passed in the country or any of the, I think it's 19 or 20 bills that have been submitted in other legislatures, with its 15-year-old age limit and its definition of terminal illness, which is that the patient is expected to die within 1 year. If Diego Morris lived in Oregon, as Senator Steiner Hayward pointed out in the Health Care Committee, he would not have been eligible. He would not be eligible for the bill as it passed the House, because he was 11 years old when he was diagnosed with his cancer. Senator Steiner Hayward had a couple of quotes on the Senate floor 2 weeks ago on House Bill 2758, which was a patient privacy law. And I was moved by those quotes, and I'd like to repeat them. I know she probably doesn't agree that they apply to this bill, but I think they do.
Mr. Buckstein, your time is up. Can you finish quickly?
I'm sorry. Okay. Let me just quote her real briefly, if I can, since I was the only supporter who was able to be here on the short notice. She said, "It's really straightforward. People of any age have a right to health care that is allowed under Oregon law." And she said, "We have long fought to keep government out of the relationship between people and their health care providers, unquote. So I think those quotes apply to this bill, and I would urge the committee not to make this law any more restrictive, but to pass it on to the Senate the way it passed in the House. Thank you.
Thank you. We're in a big hurry. I'm going to ask one question about an amendment that apparently at least a couple of people here have seen, just to make the information available for the committee, and then we're going to move on. Ms. Adamson, you've seen the Dash A9. Mr. Buckstein characterized this bill as already being more restrictive than other states' bills. With the Dash A9, in your opinion, does it make it even more restrictive yet, or does it loosen it?
Madam Chair, we don't believe that the Dash A9 makes it any more restrictive than the Dash A8s. They're very similar. The Dash A9s include some clarifying language that we believe improve the A8s, but don't. The A8s are create some additional sideboards, which we believe are critical for patient safety and ensuring that as they're making these decisions, they're doing so in a way that they're competent. It also removes applicability to children under the age of 18 and frankly aligns many of the provisions in a similar way to other sections of statute.
Thank you. We will not, as you've seen on the agenda, we do not have a work session scheduled on this bill for today. We can have a conversation about it as a committee on another day if it is scheduled for work session. But we appreciate each of you being here for the public hearing.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to speak on behalf of my colleague, but I think she needs to explain herself what she meant.
At your discretion, Madam Chair, I would say while I appreciate Mr. Buckstein's kind comments about my work, I do not consider them applicable to this bill at all. It's entirely different to talk about standard of care treatment than it is to talk about unproven treatment. I made it very clear in the Senate Health Care Committee that I had significant ethical concerns. I have bioethics training, and I, like Father Tuohy from Providence, who testified in the Senate Health Care Committee, have significant ethical concerns about the bill in its original form, in the 2300A form. That being said, I respect some of the points that have been made, and I certainly respect the work that Representative Buehler and Representative Greenlich have done on this bill, which is why I've worked very hard on the Dash A8, and I'm fine with the Dash A9s if they do what I think they do. Having talked with Ms. Adamson, I haven't actually seen them recently. I don't love this bill. I think I can get to neutral with the A9s, but I still have significant ethical concerns. I respect as a researcher and an ethicist, I respect the FDA process, and I think that's about all I'm inclined to say right now. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2300. Next, we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2825.
Thank you very much. I was trying to. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Here's the
agreement. I'm taken out of context.
Opening the public hearing on House Bill 2825, Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2825 includes a blank general fund appropriation that would provide funding to develop housing for individuals with mental illness and addiction disorders. It puts some sideboards on how that money can be spent, in specifically only funding up to 20% of construction costs. And finally, it sets up a work group to advise the agency in developing and prioritizing projects.
Thank you. We have three people signed up to testify. Chris, Jessica, Kevin. And whoever gets there first can start.
Okay.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm executive director of NAMI Oregon, the state chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. House Bill 2825, you may recollect the concept. This comes out of the 2013 special session, also the 2014 short session, where out of the cigarette tax, $5 million was allocated to go into this concept, although there wasn't legislation behind it like this, where we took that $5 million, made a 20% sideboard on it for a match, and turned it into close to $25 million in housing for individuals living with mental illness. As you know, housing in general is in short supply. It's particularly acute for people living with serious mental illness. And this concept came about as we were discussing ways to address that with our partners, such as the Oregon Residential Providers Association, trying to figure out a way to leverage state funding instead of the state paying for an entire housing project, as it sometimes has done in the past, figuring out a way to take scarce state dollars and leverage that to a degree that brings in outside financing. again, we use that concept. We've proven that it's worked. We built housing, not only respite housing in the Portland area, but supported housing that meets the U.S. Department of Justice definitions for the agreement that it has with the state for supported housing in Coos, Curry, Jackson, Lane, and Marion counties. We did it in a very compressed period of time after the legislative blessing in February of 2014. The funding went out the door, and projects were coming online as of fall of 2014. So in a very compressed period of time, the concept proved itself. This legislation is before you because what we'd like to do with our partners is essentially formalize this and make it more of a permanent feature of Oregon's community mental health system so that we can continue developing new housing around the state. We're hoping in this case for $10 million. We were successful in a short period of time to get the $5 million out the door. We feel confident in a two-year period that we can orderly and efficiently get the $10 million out the door during a competitive process. And our hope is, with the longer timeline of a biennium, to have even more projects around the state with greater geographic diversity. And with that, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. Jessica?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We are here to lend our voices in support of this important project and projects that really create an important set of opportunities for individuals with severe and persistent mental illness. We have inpatient units and intensive outpatient units, as well as ongoing care for our patients who face mental illness. It is our belief that having safe and decent housing is essential to their ongoing recovery, and believe that this is an important step forward in creating a full continuum of care for those with mental illness. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of 2825. My name is Kevin McChesney, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Residential Providers Association that collaborated with NAMI on this bill. I just wanted to point out a couple of things, and the one being that the limit, the 20% limit on construction costs. So $5 million at $130,000 a unit would pay for approximately 39 units of housing. With the 20% limit, that same $5 million pays for about 192 units of housing. And that's just a drop in the bucket. The other thing I wanted to point out is that that because of the USDOJ restrictions, really only 20% of each project can be used for people with mental illness or substance use disorders. So what this really does as well is provide a significant number of units of affordable housing which is really critical to the populations that we serve, so that many of them can live in mainstream housing. And in fact, there are rental subsidies, but that's extremely expensive and in the long run really can't be supported. So I think it's really critical that we be able to provide these affordable housing units as well as those units specifically for people with disabilities. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here who was signed up to testify on House Bill 2825? I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2825. I'm going to consult with LFO staff to determine the sequence of the remainder of the agenda.
I think we can probably do open the final on this. Just look at this.
We're going to be doing Senate Bill 226 next. If you know you're already signed up to testify, please start making your way to the front. I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 226.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 226, as currently envisioned, requires Department of Human Services to operate three regional mobile crisis teams to serve persons who reside in residential group homes. These are residents or clients of the department that reside at within the state stabilization and crisis unit program. There is an amendment in Olas Free today that actually modifies the bill to take out that requirement. Those mobile crisis teams are actually directly built into the department's budget for the 1517 recommendations you'll hear later today. What is left in the bill with that amendment is a task force that has some requirements and reporting actions during the next biennium.
Thank you.
Eva. Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, thanks so much for opportunity. My name is Eva Ripito. I'm with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. I would like to thank all of you and the agency for the time and attention on the DHS budget around the stabilization and crisis units. I want to give most of my time to Matt Orser and Nathan Kennedy because they will address the task force. But I'm here for any questions, to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 226. My name is Matt Orser. I'm president of AFSCME 1246. The stabilization and crisis units. I truly appreciate all the work and attention that has been given to SACU. As you have heard, the clients we serve now are different from the clients we serve that came from Fairview. It is for the reason we are asking for the task force is established in SB 226. The bill established a task force on the clients and staff safety. We know there is a lot that needs to be discussed in improving the conditions for the clients and staff. Specifically, there needs to be reviewed for proper placement and the impact that it may have on the housing. Nathan will address the issues around housing in his testimony. We'd also like to address the issue that we are having with the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention Investigations. We've learned that the way AWAPI handles investigations to SACU is not the same as the way they are handled in the private nonprofit houses. Throughout investigations are not done, thorough investigations are not done, and we have cases where AWAPI has shared draft decisions with SACU HR who disagree with the outcome and had the decisions changed. This is a disservice to the clients and staff. When improper investigations are not done, staff becoming unclear of expectations and proper procedures and are afraid of doing their job. We believe this fits in with the objectives of the task force to look at client and staff safety. We also would like to have a task force address issues around proper placement. Right now we have clients with high needs and difficult behaviors. who lash out and prey upon other clients. While the additional staffing that you are funding will certainly help, this is a safety risk for all. Thank you again for your time and attention. I will welcome any questions.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 226. My name is Nathan Kennedy, and I'm an elected board member at AFSCME Local 1246, Stabilization Crisis Unit. Thank you for your work on funding the float pools and the crisis outreach assessment teams. We believe the additional staff and restructuring will allow us to provide better supports to our clients. I would also like to thank those of you who recently visited the SACU home in Kaiser and took the time to visit with the staff. It was much appreciated. When we were here for the hearing on House Bill 2618A, co-chairs Bates mentioned concerns about the conditions of the housing. We are also concerned about this and would like to see this issue to be one that the task force would look at. We're renting the facilities, and the landlords often do not respond to repair requests quick enough, and that can be an unsafe conditions for the staff and the individuals living in the homes. For those of you that visited the Kaiser home, I'm sure you noticed the potholes leading to the home, the lack of lawn care due to limited staffing, the office spaces in the garage, the countless other conditions that we would like to see improved. I would like to share these final thoughts with the committee. We all see the care that is put into the facilities the state owns and the difference between the SACU facilities where people actually live and the appearance and the quality of the 500 Summer Street DHS building with a parking garage and finely manicured lawns and so forth. And people don't even live in this building. So please know that when you visited the Kaiser home, and saw the home that you saw was hands down the very best facility that we have. We would like to see the state invest in facilities that can meet the level of care our individuals deserve and need and serve Oregon for years to come. Please adopt A8 amendments and support Senate Bill 226 to create the SACU Task Force. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Anyone else signed up on this bill? Anyone wishing to speak who hadn't signed up? Thank you. Thank you for being here with us. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 226. We're in recess for just a moment here.
Madam Chair, I've had 2 hours of sleep getting here.
Yes, Representative Olson, did you have a question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, we're just staying in public hearing right now, or
I closed the public hearing. I'm about to open a work session.
Okay.
Would you like to wait?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No.
I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 226.
Madam Co-Chair, as through a testimony on, as I mentioned earlier, there is a -A8 amendment in OLIS for this bill. It removes the language from the bill about the crisis teams, retains the task force language, and changes a reporting date from September 2015 to September 2016. The bill has an indeterminate fiscal impact, and the agency will monitor workload related to it.
Madam Chair, when you get to questions.
Senator Winters.
Because I'm half sleeping, I just flew in, just for the audience sake, early this morning, so I got here so that I could be here this morning to be able to. Well, those of you who know me, that this whole issue of crisis is one that I really, really care about. And so, yes, I am ready to vote this one out.
Yes, Representative Kenny Goddard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They didn't address the amendment, so I'm just wondering if there can be a nod about whether they're supporting the amendment.
There was one statement about the amendment from the final speaker.
They do support.
Yes. Thank you for the clarification. Is Is someone prepared to make a motion to move the Dash 8 amendment to Senate Bill 226?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move Dash 8 amendments into Senate Bill 226.
Thank you. Motion has been made. Is there discussion on the motion about the amendment? Objection. Motion passes.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 226 as amended to the full Ways and Means.
Discussion. Objection. Motion passes. Some carriers. We will need carriers, indeed. 1226.
Just task force.
Do we have a carrier for full Ways and Means?
I'll take it.
Thank you, Senator Winters, for full Ways and Means. For the Senate, Senator Winters. Thank you. For the House, Representative Olson. Thank you. I am closing the work session on Senate Bill 226. And we have several people signed up. How many? On Senate Bill 841. We're going to move to Senate Bill 841 next. I'm opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 841. We have three people signed up to testify. Please come on up, and whoever arrives first should start speaking right away. And I'll let you know that we do not plan to have the work session on this one this morning. We're having the public hearing only, and I plan to see this bill on a work session at our next meeting. I'm getting nods from LFO staff that is accurate. Please begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Evan Andrews, representing Fred Meyer, Safeway, Rite Aid, and Allergan. Our clients support Senate Bill 841, which builds on a bill passed last session, Senate Bill 1579, which required insurance plans to offer medication synchronization programs to their customers. This means a patient on more than one chronic medication would be able to come to the pharmacy and pick up all of their medications on one day a month instead of making multiple trips throughout the month. Senate Bill 1579 didn't specify standards for those programs, so some barriers still exist for the successful implementation of those programs. Those barriers are addressed in Senate Bill 841A, which would create two specific standards for synchronization. The first is that it would allow for patient prorated copays for partial fills in order to get all of their medications lined up on the same day. And the second is that it allows for pharmacist dispensing fees, since the pharmacist still does all the work to dispense those partial fills. When a patient is able to synchronize their medication and pick it all up on one day a month, it allows the pharmacist and pharmacy staff to perform a monthly review of medications, which provides the opportunity to identify therapeutic and adherence issues that patients may be encountering. This is not a new program. It is something that CMS is required for the Medicare Part D program, and that program also requires prorated copays and dispensing fees. Synchronization has been shown to reduce medication waste, as well as the poor healthcare outcomes that result from decreased medication adherence. I wanted to let you know that the engrossed version of the bill is the result of negotiations among stakeholders. It has a delayed implementation date of January 1st, 2017, to allow the plans to develop the technology that would allow for prorated copays. It also includes language that states that plans may be that synchronization plans may be limited by formulary restrictions, as well as includes a carve-out for Kaiser. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cross.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. We, too, support the Senate Bill 841A. And for the very reasons that were already stated, so I won't repeat those. But as was mentioned, this program is not new, and we're just trying to kind of make it easier for the patients to participate in a medication synchronization program. I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem, on behalf of the Oregon Bioscience Association. Oregon Bioscience supports Oregon's bioscience and biotech community through networking, educational programs, enterprise support, advocacy, and the enhancement of research collaboration. Our sector employs about 17,000 Oregonians in the state and is dedicated to the safe, effective, and ethical use of the products and devices that our members create. Americans filled an estimated 3.8 billion retail prescriptions in 2011. Prescriptions, as many of you know, are one of the key ways in reducing the costs for medical treatment, especially when those patients are adhering to the prescriptions that they've received. We think that Senate Bill 841 is an excellent way to ensure that patients are effectively and ethically using their medication. It has some other great outcomes, which is reduced traffic, sustainability, ways for patients to easily get their medication. So we'd ask that you support the bill in its current form. Thank you.
Is there anyone here who meant to sign up to testify for this bill and hasn't yet? Thank you. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 841. And as I mentioned, we're not doing a work session this morning. Senator Bates is not with us at this meeting. We're hoping that he will join us and that we will see this on the agenda for the next meeting. Thank you. We're going to move to work sessions on two individual bills now. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2547 relating to housing.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2547 comes to you from the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and it establishes a task force on housing with services charged with seeking input from stakeholders in order to recommend a definition for housing with services, defining consumer rights, setting standards for licensure and registration, and investigating the market demand for housing with services projects. The task force is required to report to an interim committee by December 1st, 2015, and it sunsets December 1st, 2015. You do have the Dash A5 amendment, the staff summary, and the fiscal impact statements in ONOLIS. The Dash A5 just adds an additional member of the task force, and it modifies the composition of the task force to be more inclusive, and it doesn't change the minimal determination of the fiscal.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Stark, are you ready to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash A5 to House Bill 2547.
Thank you. Motion has been made. Discussion on the motion about the amendment. Yes.
I appreciate the amendment. I was the one who made a fuss about wanting to make sure there was a majority and minority party on this task force, so I appreciate that that was put in there. So thank you.
You were watching for that amendment.
I was.
Other discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2547 be moved to the Full Ways and Means Committee as adopted or as amended.
With a due pass.
With a due pass.
Thank you. Discussion? Objections? Motion passes. We need a carrier for Full Ways and Means. I'm happy to do that.
He's got the house.
For the Senate.
I'm happy to take it if you want, Madam Chair. What
Thank you,
prefer?
Senator Steiner Hayward in the Senate, and in the House, Representative Hoyle. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2547. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 416. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 416 requires smoke shops to pay a certification fee to the Oregon Health Authority. We heard a public hearing here a couple of weeks ago on this one. Certifications must be renewed every 5 years. Smoke shops are currently certified, but they do not pay a fee. Instead, the costs of the certification come out of funding dedicated for tobacco prevention and education. The fiscal impact is expected to be minimal.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I move Senate Bill 416 to the full committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion on the motion? Objections?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you. We need carriers in the full. Senator Steiner Hayward in the Senate, Steiner Hayward, and in the House,
I believe Representative Taylor.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you very much.
That's all the business on this bill. I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 416. We're now moving to a work session on House Bill 2618.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, last week we had a public hearing on this bill, House Bill 2618, which extends PERS, police fire benefits to the employees of the stabilization and crisis units within the Department of Human Services. Before you in OLIS today, there is a copy of the bill and bill materials, as well as a dash A4 amendment, and we talked about the amendment in the public hearing last week. It clarifies the language in the bill around the relationship between the employees and the clients of these houses. The amendment also includes appropriation language to address the fiscal impact of the measure. Because these employees will be covered by police and fire benefits, there will be a higher PERS rate assessed against the salaries of those employees, and so this provides the funding for the department to pay that higher PERS rate.
Thank you. Would someone like to move the amendment?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll move the dash 4 amendment dated 6/22.
Dash A4?
A4, sorry.
Thank you. Motion is.
The 215.
Yeah, thank you. Motion has been made. Discussion on moving the amendment into the bill. Objection. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2618A as amended to the full Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Discussion? Yes.
Just, Senator Bates and I have discussed, I don't think this is the best way to do this, but I do think it's necessary. We talked about it before, but just wanted to throw that out there one more time.
Thank you, Representative. Objections? Motion passes. And we need a carrier for full.
I'll take it.
Thank you, Senator Winters. In the Senate is Senator Dembrough. In the House, Representative Frederick. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2618. And finally.
Okay. You ready? Yes. Just let me get my stuff. I got paper.
Yes. Putting things into the filing cabinets under the desk, indeed. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 5026.
And so, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, we worked on some pieces of the Department of Human Services budget last week on Thursday. And so before you today are the remaining pieces. I would like to note that for the final work session action, we're going to actually have to come back and take that tomorrow because I do not have the final amendment to the budget bill in the packet for you today. So I just want to put you on notice that we'll need to take care of that final action tomorrow. What I'd like to do is walk through the remaining pieces of the budget. I'd like to start with program design services, and there should be packets on OLIS for each of these pieces of the budget. The format is the same as we used previously. You'll have a memo with a table. This shows a little bit budget history as well as a recommendation. For program design services, it includes the standard adjustments we've been taking for eliminating inflation and assuming a higher vacancy rate. Again, the savings from those dollars is used to reinvest in the program elsewhere. One of the main parts of this budget, this division before you today, is there is some planning funds for the efforts for the non-MAGI, which is Modified Adjusted Gross Income Eligible Assistance for Medicaid programs. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare and Medicaid Services are offering a very beneficial funding opportunity for these eligibility systems updates for states. They're offering 90-10 match over the next 3 years. The department would like to be able to take advantage of that and do some work on its systems to bring them up to date and make them more efficient. So this is initial planning funds for that project. The project was reviewed by the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Information Technology. They recommended incremental and conditional approval of the package. Their recommendation is included as part of the packet before you today. There is also a position in the budget for child welfare quality control. If you would like to take a look at the detailed spreadsheet that's attached to the memo, you will also see lines 6 through 10 include some adjustments for a rebalance action in December, as well as a transfer of a component for long-term care reporting that was moved between aging and people with disabilities and program design services. Below that, if you go to line 15, you'll see some additional updates. Some of these were related to adjustments we worked with the agency on during this reshoot process or recalibration process of the budget this spring. Some empty limitation is removed. That is an artifact from the old version of modernization. There was excess limitation built into the budget that's taken out, both federal side. A portion of that is restored with some general fund, because that federal funding limitation, removal of that made the budget out of alignment, so that's corrected. There's some position repurposing. I think we talked about this in a couple other program areas. The department is trying to work to eliminate double fills, so there's some position adjustments to correct that, and there's also some technical adjustments and transfers in the budget. I think those were the main things I wanted to point out on program design services.
Thank you. Let's start with a motion so that we can lead into discussion. Is there a motion to move the LFO preliminary budget recommendation?
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5026.
Thank you. Is there discussion on this?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to LFO and thank you to everyone who worked on this budget for putting in a good chunk for homeless and runaway youth. Really need this.
Thank you. Other discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
Madam Co-Chair, for this particular division, there are no key performance measures strictly related to program design services, so there's no KPMs to review for this division.
Okay. So we're ready to move to a different part
next.
Of the budget?
Next.
All right.
What are we doing next?
I'd like to look at, have you go to intellectual and developmental disabilities next. So earlier today, you actually took action on a couple bills related to this program. One of them we talked about, we had testimony on previously on the mobilization and, or crisis teams for this stabilization and crisis unit. That's a component of this recommendation, and you also just took action on a bill that would help those employees in that program by providing them police and fire PERS benefits. Again, within this program, there is some growth. You're going to see growth in this budget, as well as aging and people with disabilities. We had testimony during public hearings on some of the caseload activity that's going on in those areas. You will see it in the final budget action, a budget note for both the IDD and APD programs that has the agency do some additional work on trying to curtail costs and address sustainability, and they will come back and do some reporting. It's not included in this memo. It's included in that final wrap-up memo. So there is going to be some work done on that ongoing caseload and cost growth issue. Again, standard adjustments in the budget include the inflation and vacancy rate changes mentioned previously. There are reshoot adjustments related to caseload growth and cost per case changes. And there, along with those, there are some adjustments made to workload models, both for staffing within the department and staffing outside the department. Most of this program is delivered via the community development disability programs and the brokerages, so there are workload model changes for those entities to go along with the caseload growth. In the recommendation, there is $3.6 million general fund related to rule changes at the federal level that required the department to manage salary and benefits and hours for personal care workers and home care workers differently. That's not expected to necessarily cover the entire cost. There will be money, part of a special purpose appropriation in the end of session bill to help address future costs, but this is an incremental approach, in part because we're not exactly sure what all the federal decisions are going to be regarding this issue. So there is a piece included to help address that in the near term. The budget does include two adjustments for the stabilization crisis unit. One is related to developing provider capacity to, again, to try and focus client services to those truly in crisis.
Are you smelling smoke? It's they're cooking outside.
Oh, that's right. It's barbecued. Barbecue day. I had a moment of anxiety. I apologize, Madam Chair.
What is developed provider capacity? The second change relates to address safety and staffing concerns within the stabilization crisis unit. There is funding, $5.7 million general fund, $13.4 million total funds, and 120 positions added to address that staffing issue. It establishes mobile crisis teams and a float pool to help help the agency and the staff in those houses maintain appropriate staffing levels, as well as address the usage of overtime and staffing gaps. Another component in the budget is there's an increase of $8.5 million general fund and $26.7 million total funds to provide rate increases to non-bargain providers. Again, some of the providers that provide services to these clients are not in a bargaining unit. The folks in the bargaining units get those wages and salaries addressed as part of their bargaining agreement. This is for folks outside of that. There's also a $40,000 general fund add to maintain the family-to-family networks. These networks were expanded out to eight in the current biennium. This provides inflationary increase and allows them to be maintained at the current level. And then the last bullet in my memo is there is a $92,500 general fund added to the budget to be paid into the Community Housing Trust account, aka the Fairview Trust account. I don't know if you remember, but there was some property that was transferred to the city of Pendleton as part of the Blue Mountain closure. A piece of that was from the Eastern Oregon Training Center, so under statute, that many money or value of that land needed to be transferred into the trust. So there is money appropriated for that transfer to happen. And I'd like to note that there have been no other changes made to the trust. The current balance of $6 million stays within this budget recommendation in the governor's budget that was taken out to help balance the budget. So I wanted you to know that it stays in the trust as part of this recommendation.
And some might characterize it as this recommendation restores what had been appearing to be removed for a few months.
Although there are some people that would like to have more put back that was taken out a few years ago, but that's another issue. If you'd like to quickly go to the detailed spreadsheet, I think I've covered most of the things on the list in the memo. Again, caseload growth is it's about 13% between biennia. We're already seeing caseload changes. The budget does include a rate adjustment for the federal Medicaid assistance percentage. So the federal component's gone up. So there's a little bit of general fund savings captured there. There is a contract. $3.8 million comes out related to a contract with Umatilla County for transitional services for the community development and disability programs. That contract's no longer needed because those services have transitioned, so we can pull that out of the budget. There's also $900,000 in the savings system in the budget related to validating the DD assessment used for some of the to evaluate some of the clients, determine the level of services needed. There have been some discussions about that current assessment tool needing to be validated and maybe recalibrated, again, tied back to cost and wanting to make sure that the appropriate level of service and hours are being provided to clients. So the department's committed to doing work on that over the next few months. So we're assuming that there's going to be a little bit of savings achieved as that assessment is validated. And then, again, the family-to-family network increase and then the sale proceeds to the Fairview Trust are included in that recommendation.
Thank you. Is there a motion to move the preliminary budget recommendations for IDD?
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation, preliminary budget recommendations for intellectual and developmental disabilities in House Bill 5026.
Thank you. Discussion. Yes, Representative Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for helping to make sure that the rest of the Fairview Trust was not swept away, and I look forward to future conversations on seeing if we can't restore the rest at some point as well.
Thank you. Other discussion?
No.
Objections? Motion passes.
Madam Co-Chair, for this program area, there are some performance measures specifically related to the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program. There is a sheet in your packet that shows what the recommendation for the performance measures are. There are a couple of recommended modifications. KPM number 13 is got some different language to try and capture a measure related to specifically to people living at home with disabilities. Again, the in-home program has been an area of emphasis, especially over the last 2 years. And then KPM number 14, as the department continues to work with folks in the community and employment settings, we're trying to kind of tailor the language in that KPM to really reflect what the department's trying to accomplish with working with the IDD folks in employment.
Madam Chair, with regard to the change in 13, I agree with it in general. I guess the question I have is whether it's more appropriate, and I realize it's sort of late in the game, but more appropriate to say percentage of eligible people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, because I think we would all agree that there are probably some folks who, no matter what we did, probably wouldn't be appropriate or for them to live in the home setting, because it would just be too complicated. They would have needs that really couldn't be addressed well without a full-time caregiver. And so I'm okay with this KPM, but I just worry down the road we're having an unrealistic expectation, and or more accurately, we're not having the right denominator.
Just I'll comment, Senator Hayward. I believe we can make sure the agency addresses that context for us as they bring forward information on the measure. They can try and relate that back to sort of what the eligible pool is.
I think that'd be helpful.
For that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations for the key performance measures for this section of House Bill 5026. It's about the best I can do for you right now.
Thank you. Discussion on the motion about key performance measures. Objection. Motion passes.
Next. Okay, you also have a packet before you today for the aging and people with disabilities section of the budget.
So, again, there's a memo as well as an attached spreadsheet with more detail. Standard adjustments we've been using for inflation and a 3% higher vacancy rate are included in the budget. Again, there are reshoot adjustments that account for overall caseload growth and cost per case. Some of those do tie into workload models for both the aging and people with disability field offices as well as the AAAs who provide services to this client group. There is in the budget for this section, there's $14.4 million general fund related to the U.S. Department of Labor rule changes related to home care workers. Again, there will be money part of a special purpose appropriation to deal with potential future costs. This is sort of an initial increment. Again, there will be likely some decisions on some of the court action at the federal level, maybe by the end of the summer that you'll hear back on later this year, and we'll have better information. Again, some of this is due to uncertainty about those final regulations. Package 107, the funding for this package is not built into the recommendation right now, but I wanted to make sure we touched on it. It is there was a project, which is the next phase of development and implementation for the statewide adult abuse and report writing system. This was work that was initiated in the current biennium with some funding from the senior special purpose appropriation that was set aside. The next phase of the project is requested for ongoing development, but it does have a bonding component. So the total project is contingent on bonding. So I've removed it from this recommendation. It would be addressed as part of the end of session bill along with other bonding related projects. It did go before the information and technology committee, subcommittee of Ways and Means. They recommended incremental and conditional approach, and there is that recommendation attached in the packet. So I want you to make sure that this is anticipated to still be part of the budget, even though the funding is not directly in this recommendation. And in this program area, again, we had some discussions about caseload and cost growth within aging and people with disabilities. So there are some actions taken to try and help mitigate some of those cost increases. One of the actions is to take $5 million general fund and replace that with federal funds. The department is working to identify newly eligible folks who are newly eligible for the programs that should be able to qualify for full federal funding under the Affordable Care Act. They're going to work on that. We're trying to capture some of those federal funds and free up some general fund for those new eligible clients. There was some backfill provided in the current biennium to replace older American Act funding. $2 million of that backfill is pulled out. That was federal funds specifically for federally directed programs related to activities that the AAAs or services AAAs provide for clients. So that has been pulled out as an adjustment. There was an innovation fund that was provided in the current biennium. Almost all of that is removed to help balance the budget. The action does retain a portion of that fund, $350,000, to continue support for a project in the Portland area that serves older people with HIV and AIDS. It was a project that was funded out of the innovation fund in the current biennium. Another new ad that we had in the current biennium was to enhance the Gatekeeper program. This is a program that works with customer service folks in the community to help recognize a potential issue with a senior or elderly person. That funding has been pulled out of the budget. It's a discretionary population. It's not required to be funded for any of our federal funding streams, so that's been removed. And there's another last piece that's been taken out of the budget, and that's $1.8 million to provide services to help older individuals with options counseling as far as trying to figure out what they can do in the long-term care system. Again, it's another discretionary expenditure that was eliminated to help try and balance the overall budget. So there are some programmatic reductions in this plan that I wanted you to be aware of. The budget includes an additional $1.6 million general fund to pay back property taxes for seniors eligible for hardship funding. These were folks that were caught up in some of the changes of the senior deferral program. Some funding was provided that took care of a portion of those individuals in the current biennium, but it was not enough. So this is expected to take care of the remaining folks who have identified or eligible and need hardship assistance. It should be a one-time expenditure and should take care of that remaining population. Something you heard testimony on during public hearings and during the agency presentations was what has been happening with a pilot project to expand Oregon Project Independence to folks under the age of 60. That program is continued in the budget. It's at $6 million. That amount of funding is not expected to fully make the program fully available to everyone who could possibly qualify, but to continue the body of work with the individuals and the geographical areas that we've been working with under the pilot. And again, that will provide some additional information for the next budget decision-making process as far as investments in that program. And just to note then, for the regular Oregon Project Independence funding, that funding is sustained in the budget as well, so it has not been adjusted. And then $3.3 million general fund is added to extend the caregiver training that's been funded in the current biennium. This is a caregiver training that goes out to all kinds of folks that work with seniors and disabled people in the community, from direct care providers to first responders. There's quite a wide variety of folks that are taking advantage of that training, as well as simply people who care for a loved one in their home. So it's been touching a lot of folks. On the next page of the memo, page 3, there is an adjustment to increase home and community-based care provider rates by 2.5% annually. That's an increase of $6.8 million general fund and $15.8 million federal funds. There's also $200,000 general fund in the budget to support a statewide community-based needs assessment to identify needs for services or programs to better support deaf, deaf-plus, deaf-blind, hard-of-hearing, and late deafness individuals. There was a Senate bill that would have done some work in this arena. This was to try and take a more of an incremental approach to kind of figure out the next steps to try and address needs of this population. It's expected that the department will contract to get this needs assessment done so we can figure out what to do next for this group of folks. And then along with several other programs, I wanted you to know the budget does continue a $1.25 million general fund adjustment investment in evidence-based health. That was something that was not approved in the governor's budget. It has been included in this recommendation. And then the very last page of your memo, I'd like you to look at real quickly. So part of the funding available to aging and people with disabilities in the current biennium was directly tied to this 2013 special session in which funding was set aside out of the senior medical deduction savings to invest in senior programs. There were a series of investments that were made in the current biennium, and I want you to be aware of sort of what that plan is going forward. So the last page summarizes how those dollars are laid into the budget to maintain what I'm going to call the senior commitment, because a special purpose appropriation doesn't exist anymore, but this is the ongoing picture of what that funding stream looks like. There's $42 million built into the budget in various senior programs. So what you'll see at the top of that chart is the pieces that are built into the Department of Human Services budget. And then there are three pieces that are built into Oregon Health Authority or will be built into Oregon Health Authority. Item K will be put into the end of session bill that did not get put into the main part of the budget. And then the public guardianship program in long-term care was funded with the special purpose appropriation. It's ongoing. And then there's a continuing investment in elderly and disabled transportation.
If you'll look at that first section, I want to point out that item E, I want Andy to correct it. I will correct this in the information for the budget report, but we've unfortunately been carrying forward some nomenclature for this item for a while that's incorrect. It says on here that that adjustment was to increase the personal incidental fund from $30 to $100 a month. That's not actually what it was priced at. We actually increased it to $60, and then it's to be indexed to inflation. So I'm going to clarify that on the final copy for the budget report, but I wanted you to know that that's this is old language that's been there all along that was incorrect from the get-go. We never got that fixed. We actually priced that investment. So
thank you. Senator.
Thank you. Ms. Byerly, with regard to item C, and I probably should remember because I'm sure we talked about this at some point during these hearings, but those are a lot of programs that one would hope we have outcome measures on. If somebody can direct me to where we have those, if we have any results from those things, I realize that we just started them, you know, a year plus, just over a year ago, but I just wonder whether we have any sense of how many people have been trained in these various contexts, et cetera.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Hayward, we did have a report from the agency on the Caregiver Training Initiative back on some day, and I don't have that.
I'll go and look at the bill.
And there are some numbers on what they've. And again, it was still very kind of early in that process when they reported. I expect they'll be able to provide additional information moving forward into the next biennium. We can have them come talk about it in the 16th session if you'd like
Thank you.
So, but there was an interim report that was provided.
Okay, thanks.
I think I've covered everything, all the major stuff in the memo, but let me look real quickly at the detailed spreadsheet. Again, you'll see some positions built into the budget on line 20 that has to do with, again, as caseload grows up, the workload model that we use to provide staff for both the APD field and the AAAs grows as well. So there are some adjustments to that included in the budget, I think. Those are the main things I want to point out for aging people with disabilities.
Yes, Representative. I received an email from someone who's concerned about the abuse piece and having it being cut. And I just looked it up here, and it looks like it's being put into the M piece.
Oh, the system?
Yeah.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Boone. Yes, the system project I mentioned earlier, because there is a bonding component to help pay for that, the sale of coupons, it's part of the overall bonding discussion.
Okay.
I believe it will be funded ultimately, but it's not ready for prime time to put into this recommendation because the bonding has not been finalized.
So is it fair to, should I just wait on that response to that person?
You could do that.
Thank you. Just want to clarify that. Thanks.
And there were no issues that were brought up with the project in terms of moving forward as far as the IT committee was concerned or anything that I'm aware of that should continue that system development from occurring. And if the bonding component did not come through, we could revisit again ways to look at that project more incrementally or have them continue to move forward.
Okay, thank you.
Would someone like to move the LFO recommendation? The preliminary budget recommendations for aging and people with disabilities?
Madam Chair, I move the recommendation, and I would need to make a comment because I, on this, not only the aging and people with disabilities, but also the intellectual and disability. You know, as you know, I expressed concern with respect to the growth and the sustainability issue, and after having some extensive conversation with the good director, Aaron Kelly Seals, I'm assured that the agency is going to work on the issues that have been raised by this budget committee. And so with that, I am prepared to go forward with the budget. I need to put that on the record because I've been very concerned about some of the budgetary growths and concerns inside these two budgets. So I make the motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Winters. The motion has been made. Is there additional discussion? I'm going to comment that I'm disappointed that our budget situation is as it is, and there are some important things in here that are not being continued or are being funded at a somewhat lower level than ideal. One of my favorites, for example, that I would call out is the options counseling from the Aging and Disability Resource Connection, ADRC. But there are several things in this list that there just wasn't enough capacity in our budget to do everything that was requested. I certainly hope that somehow additional resources are found and we can improve the situation. But this is how it is for now, and I think it shows a very good balance of trying to take care of many different areas of need. Other discussion? Objections to the motion? Motion passes.
Madam Co-Chair, there are some key performance measures tied directly to the Aging and People with Disabilities Program. Those are in your packet. Those are pretty much being continued with the exception of KPM number 16. This is an area where the department is really trying to identify a good measure to look at adult protective services and how effective they are. There was a placeholder in the budget from last time. The department wants to go back to sort of the prior measure, at least in the short term, and that has to do with the percentage of seniors and adults who actually experience abuse. Again, the department continues to look at this area to try and find the best way to sort of gauge how the department's doing in that in its efforts to deal with abuse of seniors.
Someone like to move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures?
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations on key performance measures.
Thank you.
Discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
So, Madam Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, the next packet that I'd like you to take a look at is the packet for Central Shared Services, Statewide Assessments, Enterprise-Wide Costs. Again, these are to a certain extent, the shared services are services that the Department of Human Services provides for both Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Human Services. These are budgeted as all other funds in the agency's budget, and they are what I would call a non-ed other fund. They basically duplicate expenditures because that program performs a service, but it's also being paid for by either one of the agencies as they need those services. Standard adjustments within this program area, or these program areas, include the inflation and higher vacancy rate factor. There is some general fund that's added back to help align expenditures with updated cost allocations or revenues. I think we talked about this a little bit when we did rebalance for the department. So within the federal funding streams, what is starting to happen more is as those federal funding streams are capped or grow very limited, especially compared to things like inflation and growth in agency program, primarily related to cost load and associated cost, caseload and associated costs, those federal funds become constrained. And the budgeting methodology is to keep those more closely aligned with program, which leaves fewer federal funds for some of these centralized services. So you'll see a piece in here that has to do with maintaining capacity in central and services and enterprise-wide costs that does require some additional general fund to be placed in this piece of the budget. And when we do see federal fund savings because of federal Medicaid assistance percentage rates, that happens within the program. That doesn't happen within these centralized services. There's also a change related to DHS facility costs. So there's been over the last several months, there's been several leases that have not been renewed, which forced the agency to find new space. And typically, it's not at the most effective or high savings rate as it was in the past. So they're seeing some costs there. There's also some that combined with some existing plants to consolidate and relocate is making that budget not at the appropriate level. So there's been an adjustment for that. There's another IT project in this part of the budget. It's a shared project with the Oregon Health Authority. It's called the Real Plus D project. It has to do with analyzing data on race, ethnicity, language, and disability. It's tied to some legislation that was passed last session. You already heard about this project in the budget for OHA. The IT subcommittee did have a hearing on the project and referred it back to the Human Services Subcommittee. The recommendation is attached. And this project has been scaled down from what was initially anticipated as part of the governor's budget. Staff at the Oregon Health Authority and DHS are looking to make sure we can make use of existing technology or technology that's coming online to work on this project and keep those costs down. Policy Package 121, Oregon Enterprise Data Analytics, is funded at $3.8 million total funds. This was part of the discussion around the reinvestment of the Temporary Assistance for Needy Family package, the $30 million that was part of the self-sufficiency conversation. This piece was part of that overall plan. There were some components of the original TANF plan that had to do with evaluation and data analysis. So the intent is that some of this the work here will go to specifically look at self-sufficiency, but this was part of the package as put together for recommendation to maintain both TANF and self-sufficiency program analysis, as well as provide opportunity for the department to work more closely with data from other agencies. You hear a lot about data from housing or data from employment to try and pull some of those data pieces together so we can have better information on how programs are doing and what outcomes are like. And then the last bullet on your memo is there was another part of that TANF and reinvestment package was to fund implementation of House Bill 2393, which provides initial money to get going on exchanging data with lottery to pull in lottery winnings to recover overpayments. Again, over time, that program is expected to pay for itself, but initially we needed to have some funding to get that data sharing agreement up and running. I think those were the key points I wanted to lay out. Oh, and then related to that abuse project, since that project had has a bonding component in it, there was also a debt service component, and the debt service budget lives in statewide assessments, enterprise-wide costs. So that was pulled out. That's on line 22 of the spreadsheet. And again, when that project's dealt with in the end of session bill, that debt service will be put back in to help address the costs of that package. I think those were the highlights.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Move the LFO recommendations on shared services.
Thank you. Discussion? Ms. Byerly, I would like to follow up with you and a representative of the department about the increases in facilities costs.
And I have some more detail I can send you on that as well.
Thank you. So. Additional discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
And then, Madam Co-Chair, the key performance measures that are laid out related to this area of the agency are really overall agency performance measures. So they are the customer service measures that are standard for all agencies. So they're included in the packet, as well as the department is continuing to try and address a measure related to service equity. It's been a placeholder for biennium already, and they want to continue it in that regard. They haven't quite identified the data elements they want to fold into that, but again, they're continuing to try and come up with an actual performance measure they can use to measure that overall service equity. And those are included in your packet.
Thank you. Someone like to make a motion on key performance measures?
Move the key performance measures for shared services.
That's a really good motion.
I was happy to help, Madam Chair.
Discussion? Objections? Motion passes.
All right. The last packet before you today is the packet that has the final recommendations for the department's budget. I would like to just leave that with you. I do not have the final amendment for that for the bill. We'll have that tomorrow. But what I will tell you is in the final recommendation packet, there are a couple of budget notes, and there is some budget report language that has been requested. That is, again, the budget report will be quite lengthy and have lots of stuff in it, but there's some specific language that folks have brought forward. We want to make sure we got identified as part of the recommendation so people knew it would be in the record. So if we can carry this over till tomorrow, Madam Co-Chair, we will wrap up the last pieces of the budget, and we'll have the amendment take the final action.
That would be a great idea to stop here 2 minutes early
and some of us resume
at our next meeting. It's a big part of the budget. Thank you all for not yet. And we did, Representative Boone asked if we had adopted the key performance measures, and I believe we did.
Didn't we?
I think motion carried.
The motion carried,
yes.
But we will adopt them all one last time in the final recommendation anyway. So we're coming.
Okay, so this portion of the work session on House Bill 5026 is included. There's no other business for us right now. We're adjourned.
Nice job on the agenda.
There would be.
Nice job on the agenda.